Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet a biographer historian who's devoted his work to documenting and understanding political power. And in five remarkable books, Robert Caro has done just that. His books, Robert, Moses, The Power Broker, and the multi-volume The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, Means of Ascent, Masters of the Senate, and The Passage of Power have resulted in two Pulitzer Prizes for biography, two National Book Critics Circle Awards, the National Book Award, the Gold Medal in Biography from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and the Francis Parkman Prize from the Society of American Historians. In 2010, he received the National Humanities Medal from President Barack Obama, and in 2011, Time Magazine's Modern Library named The Power Broker one of the top 100 nonfiction books of all time. But it's the years of Lyndon Johnson that truly has had the greatest impact. Johnson's ability to uplift the downtrodden while amassing his own power at any cost has been a compelling story through four volumes already, and he's at work on the fifth. In fact, Carroll believes that understanding LBJ and his character is essential to understanding the history of the United States in the 20th century. You can hear Robert Caro as he'll be giving a University of Tulsa presidential lecture tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Allen Chapman Activity Center. The lecture is free and open to the public. I spoke with Robert Caro a few weeks ago by phone. Robert Caro, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
You have devoted your professional work to documenting and understanding the use of power and also these particular characters that effectively wield it for an amount of time. And you know, when you look at that whole spectrum, it can be everything from a very corrupt political boss to someone like Robert Moses, a power broker, or to a real political force like Lyndon B. Johnson. But yeah, when you compare at least those two, as you have written about, there seem to be a lot of the same attributes in both. What would you say the common attributes to some of those characters are?
Well, to address what you said first, Rich, you know, why are all my books interested in analyzing political power? Because, you know, here in America, political power ultimately resides with us. We confer power through our votes at the ballot box. So the more we understand about how power really works, about how political power really works, not how it works in the textbook version, but how it works in its raw reality, the better informed we will be, and the better informed our votes will be, and hopefully the better our democracy will be. So I am interested, primarily all my books about Robert Moses and Lyndon Johnson, as you say, are about political power in America.
And of course, Robert Moses never ran for anything. We never got to... He was always appointed. He used the power of authorities who were thought to be outside of politics for as his source of political power.
Of course, that's right. You know, Robert Moses is the man who built basically all the modern bridges and parks and highways in and around New York City. He was never elected to anything, as you say, but he had more power than any mayor or any governor or any mayor and governor combined. And he held that power for 44 years, almost half a century.
And in both cases, Lyndon Johnson and Robert Moses, you've written about this ability to have a great vision, and sometimes a very idealistic vision, sometimes a one-man vision in the case of Robert Moses that might have been more debatable about the wisdom of it. But nonetheless, they had this vision, and at the same time, this political power, which they could be utterly ruthless in using to, again, the means to an end. And both of those characters, as you have written about, exercise that.
Well, yes, you know, in the book that I just published, The Passage of Power, it's about basically the fight between, you know, three major characters, Lyndon Johnson on one side and John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert Kennedy on the other. And the last half of the book, you know, we have the Kennedy assassination, which I try to tell through Lyndon Johnson's eyes. And then we see him take power, and we see this man who is just a genius in the use of political power, using it, you know, almost immediately. When President Kennedy was assassinated, his legislative program, his civil rights bill, his tax cut bill, all his major legislation, health care legislation, was basically stalled in Congress. It was going nowhere. Johnson takes over, and in a matter of days, he gets all of those bills moving. civil rights bill, the tax cut bill. To watch him do that is just amazing. And so within, let's say, a week, these bills are on the road to passage. And then he really says to his advisors, you know, now I have to do something to make the presidency my own, because he's going to have to run for office in less than a year, in November 1964. And what is it that he wants to make his own? He grew up in poverty. You know, the thing that was never really understood about Lyndon Johnson was the incredible poverty and humiliation and loneliness of his youth. Growing up on this ranch where his father was going broke and losing the ranch in the hill country of Texas, very remote and poverty-stricken area. Johnson declares his war on poverty. I mean, it's a great ambition. He says, we're not going to just mitigate it, we're going to end it. And to see him formulate that program and start it through Congress, and you say, gee, you know, he was really accomplishing a lot until Vietnam came along. You really see political power, what a president can do if he really wields it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Lyndon Johnson, since in 1982, in the first pages you wrote about LBJ, you state that knowing Lyndon Baines Johnson and understanding his character is essential to understanding the history of the United States in the 20th century. That's a strong statement. And that was four books and 30 years ago. You still think that's the case today?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, more so, yeah, I think the deeper I go into it, the more I know that that is right. You know, the presidency of Lyndon Johnson is a watershed presidency in American history in the 20th century. What do I mean by that? I'm using the word watershed in the precise meaning of that term. A watershed is a continental divide, a mountain divide. On one side, the waters run one way. On the other side, the waters run the other way. The United States was a different place on November 21st, 1963, before President Kennedy was assassinated, than it was 4 years, 5 years later when Lyndon Johnson left office. It was a different place when he became president than it was when he left. So you say, what happened in those 4 years? Vietnam happened. The Great Society happened. Medicare was passed. 77 education bills were passed. The Civil Rights Act was passed. The Voting Rights Act was passed. Vietnam comes to overshadow everything. So when we talk about the 60s, when we talk about the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, we're talking about a great change in an entire nation. And Johnson's personality, his character, this incredibly strong, powerful character, is the key to everything that happened.
And while it was a very strong character, character issues are, as you've well divined through this passage over the four books, is also the character with a small c has also been important. This is a man who would steal votes not only in a senatorial campaign, but even in a legislative staffer election. It's a man who would basically tell lies about big, important things and inconsequential things.
Yes, that's an accurate summation of one part of Lyndon Johnson's character. You know, when he was in college, they said about him, he simply can't tell the truth. He lies even when he knows you know he's lying. In this book, The Passage of Power, that I just published, we see Robert Kennedy saying to his associates and friends about Lyndon Johnson, he lies even when he doesn't have to lie. That's one side of his character, and it's a constant throughout his life that he would do. He really was quite ruthless in trying to advance himself and to advance his ends. But what were the ends? That's the other side of Lyndon Johnson. Just as we see in college certain aspects of his character, we also see a real desire to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color. You know, between his sophomore and his junior years, Johnson is very poor. And he's going to a college in the depths of the Hill Country. He calls it himself the poor boys' school, and it was. But he doesn't have enough money to pay even the small tuition. And to get the money, he has to drop out of school for a year. And he teaches down in what was called the Mexican school in a little town called Cotulla, down near the Mexican border in Texas. And I wrote in that first volume, Rich, no teacher had ever cared if these kids learned or not. This teacher cared. He thought it was terribly important that they learned to speak English, so he didn't want them speaking Spanish. They were the children, mostly, of Mexican-American migrant workers. And if he heard a boy speaking in Spanish, he would spank him. If it was a girl, he'd tongue-lash them. But, you know, you could say about Lyndon Johnson, Rich, what I was trying to say was that you could say that's just an example of Johnson doing the best job he could in whatever job he had at the time, which was, in fact, a characteristic of Johnson. But the reason I feel I know that he cared, that he really wanted to help, was he didn't just teach the children. He taught the janitor at the school. The janitor's name was Tomas Coronado, and he was to recount that Johnson wanted him to learn English. So Johnson bought him a textbook, and every day before and after school, Johnson would sit with him on the steps of the school. And Coronado says, Johnson would pronounce, I would repeat. Johnson would spell, I would repeat. So both these sides of Lyndon Johnson, these violently contrasting sides, the ruthlessness, the ambition, and on the other side, the compassion, the true deep compassion to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color, both of them are evident throughout his life, in my feeling.
How, as a biographer, how do you balance these two sides? You know, this is a man that, you know, when he first went to Congress, he had an absolute passion. He had grown up in the hill country where there was no electricity, where, as you write, families lived in sort of middle-aged conditions. They're still behind a mule. They're reading by candlelight, if they're reading at all. He had a passion to bring them into the 20th century, and that's among his first achievements. At the same time, you write of lifelong friends and backers of him who supported him throughout his career, who said, I really didn't know him. They thought that if they were conservative, he was far more conservative than he let on. And if they were liberal, they said, oh, well, that's just what he has to say to get elected in Texas. He's one of us. I mean, nobody really knew him.
That's a very good summary, Rich, as a matter of fact. He would say whatever he had to say to get what he wanted from the man he was talking to. You know, a lot of people call Lyndon Johnson a reader of men, and I call him that also. He's a great reader of men. He had a gift for just finding out what somebody really wanted, what he really needed, what could move him. You know, he used to have, if I can just digress for a second, he had these rules of human behavior for his staffers. He would say, you know, when someone's talking to you, don't listen to what he says. Watch his eyes. Watch his hands. What he's saying with his eyes and his hands are always more important than what he's saying with his mouth. He would say, never let a conversation end. You keep it going because everyone has something he doesn't want to tell you. And the longer you keep him talking, the more likely it is that you'll figure out what it is that he doesn't want to say. So he would, in fact, just as you put it, he would tell the Southern senators thought he was on their side, anti-civil rights, and the liberals thought he was on their side, pro-civil rights. But in fact, he was pro-civil rights, and as soon as he gets enough power, as he does in the Passage of Power, as soon as he takes over the presidency, you know, he passes that civil rights bill.
Yes. He did the same in the Senate once he amassed power there. And, you know, he
exactly.
became majority leader within one term. That's unheard of.
His rise in the Senate, the youngest majority leader in the history of the United States, he comes to the Senate, a place where the only thing that matters. He's elected in 1948. He takes office in January 49. It's a Senate where the only thing that matters is seniority then, right? Inside one term, he first becomes assistant leader, Democratic leader. Then he becomes, when the Democrats are in the minority, minority leader. Then the Democrats become the majority, and he becomes majority leader. All in the first term, the youngest majority leader and in the history of the United States, and the most powerful and effective majority leader in the history of the United States.
And really, he was only a majority leader for 4 years.
Yeah, I think it's five, actually.
Five. Okay. Well, 55. That's right. Okay, it would have been after the 54 elections. That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So he's.
But
he's,
your point is correct. Yeah.
And yet he controlled the Senate. We watched the dysfunction of the Senate today, and you know there are no Lyndon Johnsons around today. But he literally was a maestro of the Senate.
You know, he was. It's astonishing. You say the Senate, you know, worked as the founding fathers wanted it to work, let's say up to the time before the Civil War. From the Civil War to the 18, let's say it ends in 1865, to the time he becomes majority leader in 1955, that's 90 years. The Senate is the same dysfunctional place, it seems, today. Johnson becomes majority leader, and almost instantly, it seems, the Senate becomes the center of governmental ingenuity and creativity and energy in Washington. It writes its own bills. You know, the Civil Rights Act, the first Civil Rights Act that he passes, which he does in 1957, is the one that I think you're referring to. You know, there hadn't been a Civil Rights Act since Reconstruction. Johnson passes one, and it's really his act. It's not President Eisenhower's act. It's really written as he wanted it.
And your descriptions in The Master of the Senate is that if he had the votes, he was like, call the roll quick. If he didn't have the votes, he'd say, slow it down. I mean, he was like a conductor.
You know, yeah, it's an amazing thing. You know, first, he's very tall. He's 6'4", and his arms are long, you know, even for his height, and his hands are big, even for that, you know, those long arms. And he would stand at the front row center majority leader's desk, just towering over the well of the center. And his eyes were almost at eye level with the clerk who's up on the dais calling the roll. And if Johnson knew that he had his votes there, you know, he wanted, before anything could change, right, he wanted the vote taken. So he'd raise that big arm over his head, and with a forefinger, he'd make a circling motion like an airplane or a conductor trying to get the orchestra to play faster, and the clerk would call the roll faster. If Johnson didn't quite have all his votes there, let's say if one of his votes was being rushed across Washington to the Capitol, he would make this slow down, stretching out motion with his arms, and the roll call would go slower. You know, someone wrote about him standing there. You know, he'd raise his arms. He'd gesture to the cloakroom. The door would open, and two more senators would come running in. My God, running the world, power enveloped him. That was Lyndon Johnson.
Speaking of being enveloped, when you talked to Lyndon Johnson, you didn't just speak with him. You were enveloped by him, really. He would put an arm around your shoulder. He'd have his hands on your lapel. He'd be poking you in the chest. He literally sort of embraced whether he was happy or angry with you.
Yes, he always, that was the characteristic, the arm around the shoulder, the other hand grabbing the lapel. You know, what no one writes about, people write about that he grabbed the lapel, but sometimes if the guy was proving a difficult sell, he would stick his finger through the buttonhole in the lapel of the senator he was talking to, so that the senator literally couldn't get away from him without tearing the jacket off.
That's great. My guest today is Robert Caro, the biographer of the multi-volume, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. The most recent is The Passage of Power. And the three previous volumes, Master of the Senate, Means of Ascent, and The Path to Power. He also wrote a really good biography of Robert Moses, the power broker, as well. He'll be giving a University of Tulsa presidential lecture Tuesday night, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to ask you, Johnson, early on, when he was working on a road crew, when he was utterly penniless and destitute,
yes,
told friends he wanted to be president of the United States. A couple of friends. Later, some of his Texas business buddies, as we would say here in Oklahoma, one man made an incredible offer to him when he was sort of in between. He was still serving the House. He lost his first Senate bid. He was sort of adrift, if you will, and he's saying, I need to make some money. And a man makes this incredible gesture to basically bring him into an oil partnership where he wouldn't really have to pay any money down.
Exactly.
And he says, I'm going to have to think about that for my political issues. And the friend who's overhearing this says, wait a minute, he's in a safe congressional seat. Even if he wanted to be a senator at some point, you know, the oil business can't hurt you in Texas. Lyndon Johnson was thinking about the presidency all of his life.
You know, it's interesting. These two men, you picked out a scene, Rich, that's really so revealing of Lyndon Johnson in one scene. It's how much he wanted to be president. Because he was a man, you know, to whom money, he had grown up, as I said at the beginning of this program, I think, incredibly poor, watching his father go broke, lose the ranch. He used to, you know, when he first gets to Congress, he used to say he has no money, you know. But when someone offers him basically a small fortune, a partnership in an oil company where he didn't have to put up any money, was going to make a lot of money, he turns it down because of his political future. And these two men who offer it to him, they said, you know, we thought we knew Lyndon Johnson. We thought we knew what he was interested in. Not till that moment did they realize how much he wanted to be president.
And obviously that journey into 1960 must have been a, you know, he had two bitter pills to swallow. One was not getting the Democratic nomination in 1960, and the other was losing the senatorial primary in, was it 1941 as a special election to Pappy O'Daniel, the Flower King, and that was a case of, as Franklin Roosevelt said, you know, you don't turn in your votes before the other guy.
Yes. Well, that was really, you don't turn, that's exactly right. And, you know, Roosevelt, who sort of really had a lot of fondness, Franklin Roosevelt had a lot of fondness to Lyndon Johnson. And he said, Lyndon, you didn't sit on the ballot boxes. But Johnson really made up for that the next time he ran for the Senate in 1948, because then he really carried vote stealing in Texas to extremes that it probably hasn't been seen before or since.
But my initial question, though, was about those two times after he lost the senatorial campaign. He was sort of adrift, because this is a man, he accomplished what he wanted to do in the House, and he saw how long it was going to take him to get the seniority in the House. He kind of lost interest in legislating, and I would think the same after he, you know, he went after the Democratic nomination in an old school way, and he got kind of got new schooled by John F. Kennedy. And these must have been pretty trying times for a man who really only flourished when he was exercising power.
Well, yes, that is right. I mean, after he loses that Senate race in 1941, he really is adrift. You know, he's going to be in the House of Representatives another 7 years. But in the House, you know, you're just one of a crowd. There are 435 representatives. Lyndon Johnson, you know, they said it could never stand being just one of a crowd. And he also is tormented all through his life by his belief that he's going to die young. You know, his father died of heart failure at the age of 60, but he was taken ill in his mid-50s with congestive heart failure, was an ill man, you know, ever since then. One uncle died of a heart attack in his 50s. His other uncle lasted until the 70s, but he was also sick. Johnson used to say to Lady Bird, you know, I'm going to die. My father died at 60. My uncle died in his 50s. I'm going to die young. And when Lady Bird would try to console him and say, that, you know, you'll live longer or whatever, he would say, no, it's a lead pipe cinch. So in the House of Representatives, during these 7 years, as he watches his advancement be so slow, he keeps saying, too slow, too slow. He's got to find a way to get ahead faster. And finally, in 1948, another Senate seat opens up. He runs for it, and this time he does whatever he has to, and he wins.
It was interesting. I was drawn by the parallels between that senatorial campaign in 48. You had Coke Stevenson, who was this. He went for the Senate seat in the old accepted way. Lyndon Johnson did it in a new way. He's flying around in a helicopter. He's using, you know, of course, a lot of the old stuff, which is, you know, greasing the skids, if you will, but it's also using political advertising. He's using political polling, some of the first scientific polling in a senatorial race. And so he wins, even though he still has to resort to some old-fashioned rigging to win the Senate seat. But in 1960, he's sort of undone by a new way of going for the presidency through the primary system.
Exactly. Fascinating. You know, this book, The Passage of Power, begins with who's going to be president in 1960? Who's going to be the Democratic nominee? The beginning of 1958, Lyndon Johnson is the most powerful Democrat in the United States. He's the Senate Majority Leader, the all-powerful Senate Majority Leader. He assumes, and everyone else assumes, that he is going to get the nomination and be the Democratic nominee in 1960. Well, when I said everyone else assumed, that was an incorrect statement, because the people who didn't assume it was Jack Kennedy, his brother Robert Kennedy, and the Kennedy clan. And this young senator, the first part of this book, The Passage of Power, the fourth volume in what I call The Years of Lyndon Johnson, the first part is about how this young senator races around the United States, taking the nomination away from the majority, away from Lyndon Johnson, without Johnson really realizing until it was too late what was happening. It's just a fascinating fascinating story in the old-style politics, Lyndon Johnson, versus the new-style media politics, together with the great charm of Jack Kennedy.
Do you think there's a bit of hubris involved as well? Because as you know, in Means of Ascent, you write about how he did the same thing to Coke Stevenson. I mean, although it was with some rigging, but he was doing a new-style campaign and changed the way campaigns were run in Texas.
You know, that's a terrific comparison. I hadn't even thought of it that way, but in a way, that's right. Not in a way. You're just right. Johnson changed political. You know, he was a genius in every form of politics. He didn't invent negative campaigning, but he in that 1948 campaign, he carries it to a new effectiveness, a new height through the use of media. The media then was radio. And, of course, in 1960, it's television. It's Jack Kennedy realizing that television is the new force in politics. And Johnson doesn't really realize it. And, of course, Kennedy is so great on television. And he seizes every chance to be on television. And he wins the country over.
Well, I know all of us await the final volume. This was supposed to only be three volumes, but I guess you found Johnson to be so fascinating. It's going to take five to tell the story properly.
Right. Yeah.
Well, we're looking forward to that next volume. In the meantime, it's The Passage of Power, which was out last year, and we look forward to hearing more at the presidential lecture. Robert Carroll, thanks very much for joining us.
Real pleasure. Thanks for the interview, Rich.
Historian and biographer Robert Carroll speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His most recent book is the fourth volume of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Passage of Power. He'll be giving the University of Tulsa presidential lecture tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Alan Chapman Activity Center. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.